Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
No us, no bus!
No us,
no bus!
Buses and subways are still ground to a halt in New York City after thousands of transit workers went on strike at the height of the holiday shopping and tourist season. The strike is forcing millions of people to find new ways to get around in the Big Apple. Ron Shearer is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us from his office, which, Ron, we know you walked to this morning, and apparently you weren't alone.
That's right, Rob, and I have joined other New Yorkers in what I'm calling the New York City strike diet, which is that you walk 3 miles in 21-degree temperatures and walk back again, and you lose weight.
Well, hopefully that would be the end result, but we understand people are also on bikes, on roller skates.
Oh, it's every way you can imagine people are getting to town. It brings back memories, I remember, of the earlier strike 25 years ago when, remember, we started in the sneakers to work walk.
That was in the 80s. And we understand that, you know, upwards of 7 million fares every day take the subway to and fro in New York. Mayor Bloomberg says the strike is going to deal a financial blow to the city to the tune of $400 million a day. So far, though, on Wall Street, it looks like a typical pre-holiday trading session. The New York Stock Exchange shuttled its workers to their jobs. Is there any way to judge the economic impact on this first day of the strike?
Well, I think it will be fairly significant. I mean, we obviously won't know right away, but if you go to the stores, I think they're going to be suffering, especially since people who normally come in from the suburbs to shop at this time of year don't come in. Mm-hmm. This is really difficult, and it's not just an economic hardship on the stores. I mean, for the workers, it could be a huge economic hardship for the city employees who are on strike, because we have something called the Taylor Law here, which fines them 2 days' pay for every day they're out on strike.
Well, and we understand some of the issues at hand have to do with benefits, for instance. A key issue for the unions was the transit authority's proposal to raise the age at which new employees become eligible for a full pension from 55 years old to 62 years old. And the union workers are saying that the city's transit authority is rich. They have a billion-dollar budget surplus. What's the city saying?
Well, they do, in fact, have a surplus. There's no question about that. But that surplus was not an operating surplus. That was as a result of selling assets. And so the city's reply is, well, we're going to use that to fund some unfunded pension liabilities, capital investments, that kind of thing. By 2009, their projections are that they will be back into a deficit. But these issues are really important. You had mentioned about raising the retirement age, because what we're talking about here is a two-tier system that the city was trying, or the MTA was trying to enact. And it's something that unions all over the country fight, because it's very deflating for their members to have one person get paid one thing or get benefits for, you know, one thing, and then somebody else gets something less.
Well, I imagine other unions are going to be watching this strike closely.
Oh, definitely. AFSCME, I was talking to the collective bargaining head at AFSCME, the American Federation of State, Municipal, and Employees, and they have a large contract coming due at the end of March here in New York, 120,000 workers, and they also have 40,000 in Ohio at the end of February. And so these are issues other unions are watching. In some areas, actually, they've actually been giving up the there were a couple of transit contracts that were BART and also SEPTA, and in both cases they agreed to pay higher medical premiums. The workers did that as part of their agreements. Mm.
Christian Science Monitor reporter Ron Shearer from New York City, where buses and the subway have come to a halt. It's really tough to get a cab, and if you're driving in from outside the city, you have to have four people in your car. So, Ron, good luck walking home.
I'm looking forward to it.
You're right.
Yeah.
Ron, thanks very much.
Thanks. Bye-bye, Robin.
Well, we want to switch gears a bit now to take a look at a revolutionary idea in education. The concept is to pluck 40 middle school students a year from the streets of inner-city Baltimore and enroll them in a boarding school built on a 150-acre ranch in Kenya. It was called the Baraka School, a nonprofit program supported by private and public funds, and a new film called Boys of Baraka documented this attempt to save the boys from gangs and sometimes even home life.
My neighborhood is mostly about drugs. For real. People that's out here doing drugs, sticking needle, and they all messing up their blood. I know I'm smart. If I'm not around stupid and dumb people. And I don't want my brother, my baby brother anyway, to grow up in no project.
That was Richard. When he was 12, he and his younger brother Romesh spent the 2002-2003 school year at Baraka. Filmmakers Heidi Ewing and Rachel Grady vividly captured their journey in the award-winning documentary Boys of Baraka. It's a film filled with hope, but it also has a devastating twist and an unresolved ending. And Heidi Ewing joins us from a studio in New York with more. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we just heard from Richard. And by the way, I fell in love with Richard when watching this film.
You and everyone else.
Yeah. Can you tell us, you spent so much time filming this. It's over the course of several years of their lives. Can you just describe some of the challenges that Richard and the other boys were facing in Baltimore?
These kids come from impoverished neighborhoods, many boarded up homes. On your way to school, you know, you're offered many different types of drugs or asked to come work for the drug dealers. They're living with many siblings and uncles and aunts, and the mother, mom's got two jobs and dad's in jail or not there. And so I would say that it's a very stressful environment for a child to grow up in.
Well, in the scenes that you show us early on in the Baltimore schools, Baltimore can't be happy about. I mean, they just are mayhem. Chairs flying, food flying, nobody listening. And so this is why this group is attempting to get them out of the schools. And how does this work? What's the group behind the Baraka School?
Well, the Baraka School was originally founded by the Able Foundation, which is a wonderful educational foundation in Baltimore. The concept was if you take the most disruptive few kids that are disrupting the rest of the class but have a lot of potential, if you take those kids and you remove them from the classroom and give them a chance to start over somewhere else, that everybody benefits.
Well, Richard is one of the candidates for the 2002 school year. There's a poignant moment in the beginning of the film where he goes to prison to visit his father, who spent 13 years in jail for shooting Richard's mother in the leg. She's still living. Let's listen to that scene.
We're going to Kenya. The name of the school is Baraka School. It's in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going now, so when I grow up, I'll be somebody. Mm-hmm. Don't gotta worry about coming to a place like this. Can't see my children because I'm in here.
Yeah. You know what you're doing. You're smart enough to know.
Yep.
Heidi Ewing, as we listen to that scene, again, as I got to know Richard through your film, they are smart. He is smart.
Oh, he's so smart. He's got so much going for him. I mean, just listening to that scene, it's funny. I've seen it 100 times and it gets me emotional. There is no reason that child shouldn't graduate from Princeton or become a social worker or an attorney or a business. There is nothing should stop that kid. They've got everything it takes to be successful except the guidance and the education that they need.
Well, you focus on three boys during the course of your film, Richard, and then another student is Devon, who lives with his grandmother because his mother has been struggling with drug issues. Devon wants to be a preacher. We're going to actually speak to Devon in just a few minutes, but first, here's a clip from the beginning of the film where he's showing off his skills as an aspiring preacher.
When your daughter out there nip-napping, you just got to pray. Sometimes we just all should get together and bow down on our knees and confess with our tongue that he is Lord. Because when we praise his name and give him some glory, God will come and destroy us and he will take us back up to his kingdom. Somebody say yeah.
Yeah.
A scene from the film Boys of Baraka. That's Devon. We're going to speak to him in a bit. But filmmaker Heidi Ewing, the Baraka School targeted kids in Baltimore who were most at risk. he didn't seem at risk, you know, working on being a preacher.
Well, actually, Devon is considered at risk and was considered at risk because he was always mouthing off, getting in trouble with teachers, getting thrown out of class. He had a lot of anger. I think a lot of it does have to do with the issues he was dealing with at home. And so while he didn't appear to have those kind of problems, he really did need some guidance and was definitely acting out a lot in school.
So these kids go to Kenya. Quite a culture shock. No junk food, no television, no fighting allowed. And when they first get there, they don't seem to like it very much. Here's another clip.
I miss everybody. I miss girls.
I would like you to send me some gum, some soda, some chips, and some candy.
Tell everybody I say hi. Tell the church I love them.
Some kids want to go home already. I'm one of them. You're not going to cry about it, Ma, because I am brave to do this.
It's heartbreaking. They make tapes to send back home to their mothers. But eventually, and probably predictably, the special attention they get at this school, there's only 20 of them and they're out in the middle of nowhere, it starts to work.
It does start to work. It actually did work. I mean, we would go to Kenya every few months, and every few months when we arrived, we encountered new children. We were shocked. I mean, they really snapped into line there and got very excited, and they put all their competition that used to go into fighting into grades, and it became cool to be smart because along with good behavior and good grades came special privileges like movie night and a trip to the local village or a trip to Nairobi. And, you know, these kids are smart. They're like, all right, this is what I got to do to receive these rewards. And also they got some personal satisfaction with the accolades that they were being given at the school.
They connect with home. They have phone calls with home. But and there's such a contrast between the life in Africa and the reminder of what's going on at home. Here's a phone call between Devon and his family. And his mom has been in and out of jail. And, well, you'll hear they hold back some bad news that she's back in jail from him. Let's listen.
Oh, and Grandma.
Yes?
Where Mommy at?
She hasn't come home yet.
Huh?
She spent the night
with a friend of hers. Oh. Devon? The other person has cleared.
Mwenzio amemaliza.
Go cut off. The other person has cleared.
Yeah. You know, in watching that scene, you have one camera in Baltimore, one in Kenya. When Devon asks where his mom is, everyone in the room in Baltimore just freezes because they don't want to tell him she's back in jail. And then when the line gets cut off, the look on his face, you know, where is everyone? It's a reminder that these kids are just escaping their real lives for a brief time.
Well, there is that sense of that contrast, the gap between their former lives in Baltimore and the new selves that they're encountering becomes wider and wider each day. And when the kids come home for summer break, I think they're shocked to find that while they might have moved leaps and bounds forward, at least internally, everything around them is the same and nothing has changed.
Well, and then there was another shock, a devastating one, and we're going to hear more about that after a break. We're talking with filmmaker Heidi Ewing. She and Rachel Grady directed the award-winning documentary Boys of Baraka. And when we come back, we'll speak with Devon and then hear what happened. It is not the ending that one would hope for. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been speaking with filmmaker Heidi Ewing. She and Rachel Grady directed the award-winning documentary Boys of Baraka. The film follows a group of boys from Baltimore to a special academy in Kenya, funded in part by the city of Baltimore and called the Baraka School. The idea to rescue kids from inner-city gangs and drugs and give them the tools to succeed in high school. Joining us now is one of those Baraka boys, Devon Brown. He attended Baraka in 2002-2003, and he's on the phone from the ACE Academy in Baltimore, where he's now in the 10th grade. Welcome.
Thank you.
What was it like that year that you lived at the Baraka school? You got in a little bit of trouble a couple of times.
The things that was in the movie, you know, as you can see, me getting into trouble, it was because I had to adjust to some of the discipline areas there, you know, and I did kind of carry some of the problems that I was facing here in Baltimore over to Africa. But the one thing about the school is that the school had helped us learn how to discipline ourselves.
Yeah, well we understand one point. You have told a story of counselors leaving you to walk back to the dorms in the dark one night after you acted out. What were you thinking on that walk?
I was thinking, Lord, get me home. That's what I was thinking about. You know, because, you know, I was running, trying to find my way, you know, through mm-hmm. the dark and everything. And, you know, I was tears was coming out of my eyes because I was scared. The only thing I could think about was I'm not coming back out here no more. Mm-hmm. I'm through with this. You know, get me back home. Lord, if you get me home, I swear I will be good.
Can I just say one thing? I just wanted to just to follow up on the night walk. The counselors always were there for those walks. They might have been sort of hanging behind, but just for clarity, the counselors didn't leave the kids out in the dark to walk home with animals and stuff.
But then you and the other kids after a year have to return to Baltimore. And here's a clip, Heidi, from your film of Richard, who we also met in the film, who just so charismatic. But he comes home and he is so changed, talking about what it's like to be back home.
I stay in the house most of the time. Not in front of none of these boys. Let's look at them. Coke, dope, weed. They troublemakers, tell you that much.
Again, another scene from The Boys of Baraka. That's Richard. He's looking out his window, Devon, at that point, and he's looking at the kids, mm-hmm. the drug dealers on the street. You came back and had concerns over your own. What was it like for you to come back?
I had to take what I have learned from over there, which is one thing is respect, responsibilities, and being a man and trying to get your education. I had to take what I learned over there, bring it over here, so now that I can come home, I am adapted to going to school.
But Devon, after you come back, there's another shock to the system. You guys find out that the Baraka school was closed because of security concerns. We remember there were the bombings in Mombasa, the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi closed. The parents were devastated when it was announced that the school was closed.
They might get killed here in Baltimore.
Right on the corner.
On the corner. Then they went over there.
Yeah. My son is not going to be the next statistic that's going to be out here.
Heidi, this was devastating.
It seemed so unfair and so wrong to shut the school down. And it was more than just concerns over terrorism. I mean, the reality is that the embassy in Nairobi was only closed for 1 week, and that there, you know, the school, there were some financial concerns. There was definitely some controversy at the Able Foundation whether or not to keep the program alive. And I really have to say that I think it was kind of a good excuse to shut the program down.
Well, Devon Brown, again, speaking to us from the ACE Academy, where he now attends school in Baltimore, what were your thoughts when you learned that you weren't going back?
I was a little upset. I mean, I was hurt because I was planning on going back. I was planning on doing a whole lot of things over there. But, you know, that was life. You know, it wasn't meant for me to go back over there for some reason. I don't know.
Well, Devon, even though you didn't return to the Baraka school, you seem to be doing well. You were president of your class last year. Do you think that's all because of the Baraka school?
Pretty much, yes. I think if I haven't went to the Baraka school, I don't know how my life would have ended up. You know, I think I would probably been still doing, you know, acting out and getting suspended every day. So, you know, I would say, you know, it's all because of Baraka and first of all, because of Jesus Christ. So.
And we know you plan to be Preacher Brown someday. We wish you all the best with that. Devon, we're going to let you go because we know you have to get back to your studies.
Thank
you so much.
You're welcome.
That's Devon Brown. He's one of the Baraka boys featured in Heidi's film. And actually, Heidi, I wanted to let him go as well because I wanted to ask you about some of the other boys of Baraka. Can you describe what you saw through the lens of Richard when the Baraka school closes? To me, it looked as if you could just see abandonment on his face.
It was extraordinarily painful to watch the light sort of drain out of Richard's eyes because that was almost like, in his mind, the last straw. I mean, this is a kid who has had a lifetime full of disappointment. He's had promises made and broken over and over and over again, and he trusted the Baraka School and this program to deliver him 2 years of, well, escape, really. And that didn't happen. So it was almost like the last disappointment. And there was definitely, I wouldn't say a hardening, but there was something came out of him when the school closed. You know, right now he has dropped out of school and he's going to Job Corps. And his story is unwritten still. I mean, it's hard to say what the impact in the long term was for kids like Richard and Ramesh. But they are still struggling through and they're trying to make something of themselves. But yes, I mean, you know, for them to be given a hand like this, it was desperately needed, and I am concerned for both of them in the long term.
Filmmaker Heidi Ewing. She and Rachel Grady directed the award-winning documentary Boys of Baraka. We also spoke to Devon Brown, one of the boys. He studied for a year at the Baraka School in Kenya and is now attending the ACE Academy in Baltimore. Heidi, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And by the way, this note, we contacted the ABLE Foundation and they reiterated the Baraka School was closed because the State Department warned it was not safe to travel to Kenya, not because of financial problems. There are no plans to reopen Baraka, but the ABLE Foundation now helps to pay to send students to a boarding school in rural Mississippi. And there's also an effort to build a boarding school for inner city youth within Baltimore. For more information on the film Boys of Baraka, to find out if it's playing in your area, go to our website, here-now.org. We think it's a worthy trip, by the way. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Vice President Dick Cheney is cutting short his trip to South Asia and the Middle East in order to cast tie-breaking votes in the Senate, if need be, on some of the most contentious issues before Congress. Senators are preparing for showdowns where every vote counts on drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, renewing the Patriot Act, and reining in federal spending, in part through cuts to Medicaid, all against a groundswell of anger over the president's decision to approve spying on Americans and a desire to adjourn before the holidays. Nebraska Democrat Senator Ben Nelson is so outraged over health benefit cuts that he told reporters on a conference call this morning that he's going to change his previous yes vote on the budget to a no vote.
What we're witnessing here is a shell game that cons our states and the economically disadvantaged people they serve. Now, I agree that we need to address the growth of our most expensive entitlement programs, where spending is increasing rapidly, but not at the expense of just shifting those costs and responsibility of those programs to our states.
Joining us on the line from Capitol Hill is Gail Chadwick, who covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor and has been quite busy, Gail, in the last few days. You write today that this is a dramatic endgame strategy. How so?
Well, it couldn't be more tense at this point. We're already in overtime with bumping up against holidays. Everyone is changing plane reservations day by day. But two of the most important bills in the must-pass spending package are still sitting here, the defense spending bill and labor, health, human services, education bill as well. There's a Patriot Act that stalled, that expires, 16 provisions of which expire at the end of the month. And we have a dramatic face-off over a bill that would cut about $40 billion in spending as well, all to be resolved in the next couple of days.
Well, let's start with the defense spending bill. It includes ANWR, money for avian flu, Katrina reconstruction, and the Senator McCain ban on torture, kind of a wide swath there in one defense bill. Now, Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska is pushing hard for this measure. The drilling would be in his region. But why is he pushing so hard?
Because this is the most likely vehicle for getting drilling in the Alaskan wilderness. He's been after this for a whole generation, he says, and this is the time to do it. Now, the trouble is, a defense bill can be filibustered. If it is, then the money for troops, the money for war, will not go forward this session. They'll have to find some sort of an extension. So it's a very, very high-cost vote, whether you're for or against it. There are Democrats who do not want to see drilling in the Arctic, but they also don't want to see ads about their voting against the troops at a time of a shooting war. Mm-hmm. So it couldn't be more dramatic.
And of course,
the vice president is flying back.
Right. And was it this tight in weeks previous? I mean, are there other political reasons why the vote has become this tight?
I think there are lots of them. The climate has shifted since the revelation that there has been domestic spying. It dramatically changed prospects for the Patriot Act last week. And I think it is coloring a lot of what's going on right now. Republicans and Democrats are very alarmed at this, what they see as an abuse of presidential power and an overreach, a president who sets himself above the law, and it's become a subtext for everything else that's going on up here.
Well, at one point there was some thought that there might be some compromise on the Patriot Act, maybe an extension. What do you think? Do you think that that's possible, or is it dead?
You know, I cannot believe that when we leave, it's going to be dead, because everyone says it's too important. Everyone supports it. The principles of it, for example, the elimination of the wall between law enforcement and intelligence. But at this point, the House is gone. The president says he will not sign an extension, and Senator Frist says he won't allow it to be discussed on the floor. And as far as I can see, the discussions among the principals just aren't happening. So the unthinkable may be thinkable by the end of the week.
Well let's also take a quick look at the deficit reduction bill. We heard from Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska, who's pushing hard, switched his vote. This is a bill that includes Medicaid cuts and a 1% across-the-board cut for almost all programs except veterans programs. Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana is another Democrat who supported the budget last month and is set to switch her vote because the bill no longer contains aid for Katrina victims. But why is Ben Nelson so against the bill?
You know, it may be hard to believe, but a lot of members still don't know what's in this bill. It was 774 pages delivered at 1:12 a.m. early Sunday morning. Members didn't even have a chance to read it before they voted on it in the House. And so in the last few days, you've seen interest groups really dig into that bill, lobbyists as well, and they're passing information as well as congressional staff to figure out just what's in this bill. And I think that's, as the more senators learn about it, especially the moderates, the more difficult it becomes for them to swallow.
And as we said, his Senator Nelson's disagreement is with this seeming move of Medicaid debt from the federal government to the states. And we're going to be focusing a lot on Medicaid, as many people are. Many people are surprised at how much the states are involved in what is really a federal program.
Well, Senator Nelson is a former governor, and he takes that executive power very seriously. I think he's going back to his days of seeing mandates from the federal government strain state budgets to the breaking point. Of course, states, unlike the federal government, can't run deficits.
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. While we have you, today Vice President Dick Cheney strongly defended the president's order allowing domestic spying without warrants on terror suspects. Leaders such as Arlen Specter and Senator John Rockefeller, a Democrat of West Virginia, say that's a real problem. Much debate in the country about this. How much of a negative impact is this having on the Bush administration? And, you know, we have to bring up the I word. Is there any talk of impeachment?
Yes. It came up for the first time yesterday with Senator Barbara Boxer of California. I think it's a great exaggeration to say that sentiment is generally felt. But I can say, especially from someone as pivotal in all of this as Senator Specter, that he had very strong words with the Attorney General yesterday on his on the advice he gave to the President that this was acceptable and within the bounds of law. We have a court, a FISA court, set up explicitly for this sort of thing. Had the President not felt it wasn't adequate, he should have come to the Congress, Senator Specter says, and not simply set the law aside himself. These feelings run very deep. And I think there you'll see them in high relief in January when the Congress returns.
And Gail, we're also hearing still members of the Bush administration say that they needed to do this because of the immediacy. But doesn't the existing law allow them to, you know, follow through with a wiretap and then within 72 hours go to a court so they could take immediate action?
Yes. Which is why you're seeing, I think it's also interesting to see Senator Rockefeller, who was advised about it and released publicly today a secret memo he sent to the White House protesting that this was not necessary. We haven't heard much from the intelligence committees yet, and they are pivotal as well in determining how their colleagues come to view what happened here.
Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, the new film Syriana is a rich, tension-filled, and timely brew of oil, politics, and money. It's also teeming with Arab actors, whose roles range from suicide bombers to royalty. Sudanese-British actor Alexander Siddig plays Prince Nasir, the reform-minded member of royalty who seeks to succeed his father and rule his oil-rich, fictional Middle Eastern country. In this scene, Prince Nasir gets a tongue-lashing from the equally reform-minded American energy analyst, played by Matt Damon, who tells the prince how Westerners view his country.
20 years ago, you had the highest GNP in the world. Today, you're tied with Albania. So, good work. Your second biggest export is secondhand goods, followed closely by dates, for which you lose 5 cents a pound. You want to know what the business world thinks of you? We think 100 years ago, you were living out here in tents in the desert, chopping each other's heads off, and that's exactly where you're going to be in another 100.
So now you're my economic advisor. Why don't you tell me something I don't already know?
In the film Syriana, competing forces from Lebanon's Hezbollah to rogue American spies to sinister oil executives threaten not just Prince Nasir's aspirations for his kingdom, but his life. Alexander Siddig joins us now on the line from London to talk about this rich role. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
And we should also say people are saying, Alexander Siddig, he appeared in Kingdom of Heaven, the film, and he's best known as Dr. Julian Bashir in the long-running TV series Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
That's right.
Which we want to ask you about as well. But
okay.
Prince Nasir, how did you approach that role?
It was an extraordinary privilege, apart from anything else, to read a role by a writer whose work I already admired, Stephen Gagan, who won, of course, the Oscar for Traffic. Mm-hmm. And I noticed it was this wonderful, fleshed-out, extraordinary character who was in a quandary, given the fact he was about to or trying to rule a Middle Eastern country in today's modern political climate. And his ideals sort of ended up taking a bit of a back seat to the pragmatism of politics in his day.
You've said that you based your role in part on members of your own family. Your uncle was the former prime minister of Sudan?
Yeah. My uncle was a former prime minister of Sudan, and our party, called the Umma Party, is a very strong political party in Sudan even today. I don't know if I consciously based it on him because it's a tricky, otherwise, to do a pastiche of a man who's around and is related to me is a tricky thing to do. But, I mean, I couldn't help but be influenced by the fact that I know him.
And it said that your uncle dreamt, as you said, of reform. We have another clip from Syriana where your character, Prince Nasir, talks about why he wants to rule his country and the problems involved. Let's listen.
I want to create a parliament. I want to give women the right to vote. I want an independent judiciary. I want to start a petroleum exchange in the Middle East. Cut the speculators out of the business. Why are the major oil exchanges in London and New York anyway? I'll put all of our energy up for competitive bidding. I'll run pipe through Iran to Europe, like you proposed. I'll ship to China. Anything that achieves efficiency and maximizes profit. Profit which I will then use to rebuild my country.
Great. That's exactly what you should do.
Exactly. Except your president rings my father and says I've got unemployment in Texas, Kansas, Washington State. One phone call later, we're stealing out of our social programs in order to buy overpriced airplanes. We owed the Americans, but we've repaid that debt. I accepted a Chinese bid, the highest bid. And suddenly I'm a terrorist. I'm a godless communist.
We're talking with the actor Alexander Siddig, and there are so many complicated, nuanced characters in the film. I mean, you could simplify it by saying good Americans, bad Americans.
Yeah.
Good Arabs.
If you wanted to talk in absolutes, you could. I mean, I'm proud of the complexity of the film. I think that one of the things, the strongest things about the film is its complexity.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the scene in which some Pakistani workers, impoverished workers who come to work in this seems to be Saudi oil fields, you know, the rich Arab countries' oil fields, are beaten by what appears to be, again, Saudis. on a line while they wait for work. I mean,
that's right.
Tell us about the complicated picture of the Arabs that the film tries to present.
Like any country, there are, I mean, if I'm going to talk again in absolutes, bad people, good people, and all different shades of gray in between those two extremes. And in the Arab world, it's certainly no exception. And this movie is trying very careful not to patronize the Arabs by painting too bright a picture, you know, or denigrate them by saying that they're all evil, crazy people who are willing to blow themselves up on planes, for goodness sake.
Alexander Siddig appears in the political thriller Syriana. We'll hear more about his life and how it affected the film. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the new film Syriana, Sudanese-English actor Alexander Siddig plays the reform-minded prince of a fictional Middle Eastern country, trying to respond to both the needs of his poor and increasingly agitated people and to Chinese and American oil executives competing for his country's biggest asset, its oil. In this scene, Prince Nasir asks his American economic advisor, played by Matt Damon, why his brother and cousins are talking to executives of an American oil company.
My cousins aren't bright enough to be anything but finger puppets. And my brother has faith only in his own cunning. What do you suppose they're up to, my brother and these American lawyers? Tell me, what are they thinking? They're thinking that it's running out. It's running out. And 90% of what's left is in the Middle East. Look at the progression. Versailles, Suez, 1973, Gulf War I, Gulf War II. This is a fight to the death. So what are they thinking? Great. They're thinking, keep playing. Keep buying yourself new toys. Keep spending $50,000 a night on your hotel room. But don't invest in your infrastructure. Don't build a real economy. So that when you finally wake up, they will have sucked you dry, and you will have squandered the greatest natural resource in history.
The role of Prince Nasir is significant in that actors of Middle Eastern descent are most often asked to play terrorists, something Alexander has done as well, although he's best known to American audiences as Julian Bashir in the long-running TV series Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Well, Alexander Siddig is with us now from London, and Alexander, you said the role of Prince Nasir was influenced in part by the conflicts faced by your once reform-minded uncle. He was Prime Minister of Sudan. Do you think there are other Prince Nasir years out there who want to change the system?
I do think so. I don't think my uncle is. I mean, I've really got to do a lot more work on what my uncle has done over the years to say whether or not I'm proud of his achievements, because some of the things I'm not really sure about.
Such as?
Sudan has had a history of atrocity and civil war, and obviously politicians are given to making tough decisions, and some of those decisions include killing innocent people. And to what degree my uncle was involved in that kind of action in the South, I am not yet sure.
And let's remind people, your mother was a British, so you fled Sudan with your mom when some of the conflict started there. There was a civil war between the Christians in the South and the Arab rulers in the North. There's also the ongoing conflict in Darfur between the government-controlled Arab militia and the indigenous African people.
Yeah.
This must be difficult for you to observe.
It's really hard. It's really hard because I have two cultures in me, my English culture, Western culture, if you like, and my Sudanese Arabic culture, if you like, and they are conflicted. They're conflicted on the planet, and culturally they're conflicted. I just realize, of course, that the people behind those cultures are the same and are just as able to be great friends as they are to be great enemies. We just have to push them towards being great friends.
And here you've been saying that while your uncle was somewhat reform-minded, I think you said that, you're also not sure, as an Arab leader in this country which has been committing genocide, you know, against other peoples.
I don't know how clean his hands are, and I'm not sure I'll ever find out, but I'm going to ask him when I next see him, which is very rarely, of course.
Yeah, because you don't go back?
I don't go back. It's a war-torn place. I mean, I'm tempted to go back now and just explore and say hi to the family. After all, they're family, and they'll be happy to see me, just as any family member would be happy to see another family member.
And scary to think of asking that question of a family member.
Yeah, I guess it will be. It'll be tough, but you know, I think frankness between family is certainly. I've got more chance of getting away with it than most people have. I'm sure he knows that I'm a conduit to the world. So he's not going to tell me anything indiscreet or something he might be ashamed of. I'd have to research that elsewhere.
But it does feel as if there might be another movie down the road.
There might be another movie down the road, yeah. Right.
Well, Alexander Siddig, again, playing Prince Nasir in the current movie, Syriana, we mentioned how important a role that is for a Sudanese-British actor.
Really?
Because it is the good guy. You've played the bad guys.
Yes. Well, I mean, I try and play any guy that I think is going to make a contribution to the general, the big discussion. And that big discussion is how are we going to better understand each other as cultures. So I played, I don't know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who I believe is in prison somewhere under American arrest, who was Bin Laden's number two for a long time.
The suspected mastermind of the 9/11 bombings.
And the mastermind of the 9/11 bombing, mm-hmm. yeah. And I thought it was important to play that role because, again, to when you get, as an actor, get a chance to play roles like that, you do hopefully begin to understand them yourself, and maybe through that process, other people get to understand.
But then I'm thinking of actress Shoreh Aghdashloo, who was nominated for an Academy Award for The House of Sand and Fog,
right.
but then heavily criticized for appearing as a member of a terrorist cell in the show 24.
Well, actors like her and me, to a certain degree, get very little choice in what they pick. I'm luckier than her because of the fact that I'm you know, part of an institution. I've been Star Trek. I've done loads of other stuff. So people generally know me, and I'm a kind of safe bet. But for new Arab actors and actresses, it's incredibly hard because people don't automatically sit down at a desk and say, you know what, I'm going to write a story with an Arab in it. We're hoping that people do that as more and more Arabs become familiar to us. And hopefully they're not Arab at all. They're just a person who happens to be Arab who's playing a character called Jane or Jack. That would be great, too.
Alexander Siddig, a couple last questions.
Yeah.
You also appeared as an Algerian agent in the British spy series Spooks. It's known in the U.S. as MI5.
That's right.
Very controversial at the time, but oddly prescient show about suicide bombers out of a mosque in Britain. It aired back in 2003, a year before the London public transport bombings.
Yeah.
You grew up in London. When you played in that episode, did it feel like fiction to you at the time, like this could never happen?
It felt like it absolutely could happen, that there were suicide cells being developed in England. It seemed like a perfectly logical place to develop them. After all, there are lots of indigenous sympathetic people to the more radical elements of Islam already living in England. And it's quite a tight job for the government to keep control of that and see who's who and who's actually breaking the law and who isn't. Mm. So it wasn't too tough. I think it's more likely, of course, that those sort of suicide cells and horrifying kind of situations like that were going to be bred or at least weaned in developing and underdeveloped countries because it's harder for police to notice what's going on underneath their own noses, whereas in the West, we're a bit more up to speed and have better technology to discover these people. Mm. But it seemed completely normal to me, and hopefully that's the nearest I ever get to a situation like that.
Mm. With all the work that you've done since Star Trek Deep Space Nine went off the air more than 5 years ago, does it bother you that you are still approached by people dressed up as Klingons with batlas?
No, I love Klingons. I have no problem with them at all. Some of the nicest people I've known in the whole fan world have been Star Trek fans, and so I love hanging out with them, meeting them, and I go to conventions every now and then. I mean, not very often, unfortunately. But every now and then I get to go, and I get to meet a whole, 2,000 of them in one go. And I talk with them, and we have chats, and we go for a drink after the show. I enjoy the Star Trek fans, and I'm looking forward to knowing them for a long, long time.
Alexander Siddig, he appears as Prince Nasir in the new political thriller Syriana. He's speaking to us from London. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's a real, real pleasure.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.